nobody to harm. Still, it's a real good bet. The best is yet to come.
Welcome to the roundtable for this morning. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Our music today is by the amazing Cameroonian-American jazz vocalist Ekep Nkwele. She's performing a program entitled Ella Fitzgerald Against All Odds at Hudson Hall in Hudson, New York, as part of the 2024 Hudson Jazz Festival, taking place October 4th through the 6th. We will hear more recordings of Ekep Nkwele, a star on the rise, an incredible, incredible vocalist, coming up throughout the show. To learn more about the Hudson Jazz Festival, hudsonhall.org. I am Sarah LaDuke, in for Joe Donahue this morning. The lockbox is open. Please show your support for WAMC by visiting wamc.org anytime. Absolutely anytime. The website is open 24/7 and available to receive your support. The panel this morning, public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning, good morning. What a lovely day.
Hello there. We also welcome Senior Fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer. Hi, Jim. How are you?
Hi. Good morning. I just want to say there's a great lineup for that jazz festival.
Yes, indeed.
And if you haven't been to Hudson Hall, you're really missing out. It's a fantastic venue.
It's a beautiful space. Excellent people work there, and we just love it. They're good friends to the station and friends of the program, and they've put together another amazing festival lineup. Also joining us in studio this morning, investment banker on Wall Street, the king of the Dahlia, Mark Whitman. Hello, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, Sarah.
Did you bring flowers today?
I did. I brought flowers. I'll tell you a really cute story. I brought them to the ice rink where my son plays like 3 days ago, and then I saw them again 3 days later, and they were starting to wilt, and I said, well, I can throw them away. And the woman almost bit my hand off as I reached to dispose of them. There was still some life left. So I'm going to bring her some on Saturday as well. We're back there for a game tomorrow.
It's very good of you to share them. They are really, really gorgeous.
What's the whole point of growing them is to share them.
Flowers really brighten the day.
All right. So let us see if we can not darken the day too much discussing news from around the world. Let's go first to New York City. The mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, has been charged with accepting bribes and illegal campaign contributions from foreign sources after an indictment was filed against the leader of one of the world's biggest cities. This is from The Guardian. In a 5-count criminal indictment, prosecutors allege that before and during his terms as mayor, Adams, quote, sought and accepted improper valuable benefits such as luxury international travel, including from wealthy foreign business people, and at least one Turkish government official seeking to gain influence over him, end quote. The criminal counts against Adams include conspiracy to commit wire fraud and to receive campaign contributions by foreign nationals, wire fraud and solicitation of a contribution by a foreign national. Adams' arraignment is scheduled for noon today before Magistrate Judge Catherine Parker. The complaint focuses on trips Adams and his partner took to Turkey, India, and Ghana on Turkish Airlines, sometimes staying in luxury hotels that, as an elected official, he should have disclosed to the government and campaign contributors made by Turkish officials through a system of straw donors. The indictment notes that at the time when Turkey allegedly called up those debts, there was a building close to the UN that would have failed a Fire Department of New York inspection, and Turkey insisted that Adams pressure the FDNY to approve construction and opening of that building. Shortly before, prosecutors held a press conference yesterday to announce the charges. Adams held his own, surrounded by clergy and family, as well as protesters calling for his resignation. The mayor insists that he's innocent and says he will not resign. Jim.
Yeah, well,
a lot to this.
Yeah, there is a lot to this.
I didn't get to all of it, of course.
I think there's so much to unpack on this. And it's interesting on so many different levels. I mean, it's New York City is a city. So there's the locality of running the city. It's also part of New York State, which many people around the world always kind of forget about.
Yeah.
And there's interesting things I think we can explore about the relationship between the state and the city, in particular the governor and the mayor at this point. But it's also it's a global city. And so if it were a country, it would be a major player as a country, both in its just its size, its economic heft, and its importance globally. So somebody who is the mayor of New York City is always going to be on the global, the local, and the state stage, and a ripe target for those who would like to influence that person, influence them in a way that leads to transactions. I mean, particularly foreign governments, you know, are not giving over this money. And this particular amount of money wasn't a huge amount, but anybody who's ever taken a long-haul international flight knows that you, if you're in coach, you really want to be in business or first class. So the amount of money might not be a lot, but clearly the transactional nature of this is important. I've lived in places around the world where there is such corruption around the building of buildings, the inspection of buildings, and there are real consequences to this as well. They do catch on fire and people die if the fire systems are not proper. They do collapse if the building codes are not followed. So to have this happen in New York City, it's not the first time that it's happened, but to have the mayor indicted, this is the first time. The governor has the power to remove the mayor if she wants to. She put out a statement that hedged on what should happen, and I think she's waiting. A lot of people are waiting to see what is going to transpire over the next few days. I also saw that Al Sharpton came out and said, what would be the effects of Adams staying in office, trying to vigorously defend himself, and would that affect the Harris-Waltz campaign? Would there be any blowback on that? And he's convening meetings and meeting with leaders. So I'm sure that the pressure will continue on Adams to resign. The pressure will continue on Governor Hochul to remove him from office. And the last thing I would say about this is that, you know, I think this is really just one more story of a much bigger story of foreign money influencing people like now a convicted former Senator Bob Menendez, the $10 million that was alleged to have gone to Trump from the Egyptian government. There's a lot of foreign money that washes around our think tanks and research institutes, and it's all with a purpose. And it just seems like they're finding fertile ground to peddle influence, and they're finding enough people to take it at, in some cases, a relatively low cost. But once you've got somebody on the hook, once they've gone bad and they're taking your money, you can ask them to do all sorts of things.
The email address to join the conversation this morning is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Teresa.
Innocent until proven guilty. Obviously, I think one of the challenges is it appears to reach so deep into his administration that the question of whether or not he stays and goes is not just about him. It's about a broad swath of his key people in his administration. So I think that ups the ante about whether how stable the his administration would be. And they appear to literally have the receipts and the recordings and other things. But again, innocent till proven guilty. And I think that, you know, then the key question over the next couple of days is, does he resign? I can't imagine the governor removing him, but we don't know all the facts yet. That's pretty complicated. If he does resign, there is a process. It's the public advocate becomes a mayor until there's a special election. That's Jumaane Williams. So, I mean, it's clear what the path is, at least in the short term, for transfer of leadership. I don't think he has any particularly close relationship to Vice President Harris, so I'm not sure what the intersection with the campaign is. In terms of getting the vote out or anything like that. But I was interested in you mentioning the $10 million to Trump, because, I mean, this, I don't say this as a way to say it's not a small thing. I think it is a big thing. But as you, I think, very insightfully pointed out, and this is what I was thinking last night, is this range of situations we've seen about foreign influence and foreign money. I also saw yesterday in the New York Times, and I don't think this has gotten much attention, but Jared Kushner's fund has reached millions of dollars in fees and returned no profit so far. This is out of a report that came out from the Senate Finance Committee. They have done an inquiry, and as people may recall, in 2021, he got money from Saudi Arabia and other foreign investors, and he has, according to this report, he has reaped about $112 million in fees so far with no payouts. And it raises a lot of questions about what really is that money. And I think maybe if you could speak more to the $10 million that Trump got. I mean, this is, and you says Menendez, what's the overall implication of the range of all of this?
I just want to say one further thing about that $10 million and Trump. I mean, part of that story was that Bill Barr allegedly quashed the case and told the Justice Department not to pursue it. And I think in normal circumstances, you would see members of Congress saying, okay, let's get Barr under oath, let's have a public hearing and have him answer some tough questions. But what we can see from this, the range of cases we see already with influence peddling, this is a bipartisan affair. And I think many members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, unfortunately, are reluctant to hold people's feet to the fire because this is just the tip of the iceberg. There's more going on. I mean, even just with the Egypt money, people don't want to rock the boat on Egypt because Democrats and Republicans, members of Congress across the country, benefit from that Egypt relationship because there's huge amounts, billions of dollars that are spent on defense contractors that are spread across the country, including in our listening area. And so we haven't heard anything about that really since the Washington Post broke that story, and that is telling, that the silence is telling.
Right. That's been stunning to me that so little attention has been given to that $10 million. I mean, it just seemed, and to the Jared Kushner, you know, as soon as he leaves the White House.
Jared Kushner, the potential future Secretary of State of the country.
Right, right. And as the Senator Wyden pointed out in this report that came out, he's a committee chairman, that he create, you know, that they're looking at the potential conflicts of interest that this creates, particularly with his father-in-law, you know, running for president. And but I also worry, and this is Pollyannish of me, but I also worry about this constant sense that all politicians are corrupt and that you can't trust anybody in government. I think that that's not the case, but what gets the focus is those who are, and what doesn't get the focus is those who aren't, you know, and because they're going about their day-to-day business. But I think it just chips away at the confidence of our government, which I think is really unfortunate.
Mark Whitman.
Well, first of all, I do think there's a important intersection with national politics. And if you missed it, Trump himself said that he thought, I don't know if he said he's claiming, he said or he thought that I knew that when Adam stood up to Biden, the Biden administration with respect to immigration and the influx of immigrants into New York, I knew they'd indict him.
But that was a ridiculous statement.
I understand it's a ridiculous statement, but you know what? It underscores but Adams himself has asserted that the reason he's in trouble is because, now, I agree with you're innocent until proven guilty, but let me tell you, I think that intersection makes it profoundly disappointing that so many politicians in New York have failed to show leadership and spine. I mean, I'll give it to AOC. She came out right away and said the guy should resign. Our paint-by-numbers governor infuriates me. I understand the guy's innocent, but he's charged with serious crimes that affect, and there's so much smoke and fire already around his administration. She should have come out yesterday and said, I'll make this easy for Mayor Adams. If he doesn't resign, I will remove him. She needs to show some political background. And so too, you know, Schumer, Hakeem Jeffries, and Gillibrand all came out with wishy-washy statements that were just stomach-churning when you hear them, frankly. The other thing I want to point out is I read sort of more of the background on this than I knew beforehand. And I'll tell you what, when you read that somebody's got a head of campaign finance who's a 25-year-old, that should set off alarm bells. I will tell you from my perspective in finance. Almost any time I have seen subterfuge with prospective financing, there is this incredible desire to put in place some patsy in the position of control. And the minute you see somebody of that lack of experience and age in a position like that, you need to take three steps back and wonder why it is that that's the best person they could find for the job. The other thing I'll say here is it's too bad.
Do you know this person? Do you know that he or she is not qualified?
Yes. A 25-year-old is not qualified.
Do you know the qualifications of the person?
No, I don't know them, but I will tell you this.
A 25-year-old
is not qualified to be the head of a campaign finance organization that that is responsible for millions of dollars of contribution. Full stop. The reason why...
A friend of mine, a person I know is 27 years old, and he was a treasurer of the state of Michigan. So, I mean, it just depends on the skill of the person. Yeah, I don't know anything about this person. I just worry about denigrating somebody that we don't really know.
Well, but to denigrate them given the acts that they've allegedly been involved in. The issue is, by the way, she would have been 22 a couple years ago when this all started, or even younger. When you have somebody whose past experience is so short, they have no reputation that they feel they have to defend. And when they get put in a morally compromising position, they too often, not always, make bad choices. So I'm not saying that all the wildebeest get eaten by the alligators, but seeing them run across the river, too many of them do too often. I'm just saying from a financial control standpoint, and I've had financial organizations try to tell me, well, don't worry, this 28-year-old can be my CFO. And if I had any other doubts about them, which in that case I did, I took 3 steps back and our bank packed up our bags. Other banks step in and the guy was found guilty of fraud, as was the CFO, and he went to jail. I've just seen the movie too many times. I'm sure there are capable, ethical 28-year-olds, but there are so few of them. And guess what? If you let them wait a little bit till they're 34, they're even more capable. So that I'm just saying it's a big red flag that I've seen it. But I want to return. It's just disappointing, particularly our paint-by-numbers governor, just can't get on TV and say, look, I understand he's innocent, but there's already been too many casualties around this investigation. I mean, for God's sake, Eric Adams' whole cadre of advisors shows up every other day at T-Mobile for a new phone because the government keeps taking them away. And this isn't a bar fight that he had before he was mayor. This is allegedly affecting not only his ability to be mayor, i.e. the campaign funds, but it's also an act that he allegedly performed while mayor. And if he's innocent, go prove yourself innocent, and then I, as governor, if I make the call, and everybody else will suffer your wrath. But in the meantime, I'm going to take a leadership decision and tell you to sit down and resign, or I'll make you resign.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We will return to this topic, allow, of course, rebuttals or points from our other panelists, and take some of your questions. You can always donate to the Lockbox, WAMC.org, absolutely anytime, even when we're not telling you about it. We'll be back after news from the BBC.
Memories of days gone by in my solitude.
Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue this morning. Our music today is by Ekep Nkwele, a Cameroonian-American vocalist performing Ella Fitzgerald Against All Odds as part of the Hudson Jazz Festival in Hudson, New York, October 4th through the 6th, hudsonhall.org. The playlist is posted online at WAMC.org. You can email the panel@WAMC.org. You can pledge online at WAMC.org. WAMC.org is busy. It's providing things for you. The playlist, that was our email address, and you can pledge. Let us return to the topic at hand. We've been discussing the mayor of New York City's recent indictment, the first of a sitting mayor of New York City, and I will throw the airwaves to you, Jim Ketterer.
Yeah, so I just want to mention one other element that we haven't discussed yet, but that is, and this certainly has to be on the mind of the governor, and on the mind of the political people in New York City, and that is that there's one person lurking in the wings on this, and that's Andrew Cuomo. And so we know that the current governor has a very special relationship with Andrew Cuomo, probably not a good one, and that Andrew Cuomo has already been making noises about potentially running for office. And so if Adams is removed and or has to resign, and then that becomes an open seat, politically it's really a different calculation and probably an easier calculation for Cuomo to not have to run against an incumbent, which is always difficult, even if they've had difficulties while in office. So that's just another element to this story. I think for the governor, you know, this is both a legal decision because, as I understand it, it's never been done before. It's possible, but it hasn't been done. And there are some New York constitutional issues that would have to be sorted out. And the other is just the politics of it. I mean, she said she's going to run again. Would this harm her in any way? Would it make her appear strong and a decisive leader in the way that Mark was saying? Or would it seem like she is undermining her support with black voters or some combination of those two? And I think that's the kind of thing that Sharpton was talking about as it relates to the presidential race. I'm sure that the Harris people are like, you know, we need this kind of issue like a hole in the head. So even more complications.
I think she's right to give it some time and give him some time and see how this evolves. I was interested in a bit of the commentary after the fact that a number of people, leaders in the city, were talking not only about his behavior in terms of this potential illegal activity, but his policy choices and deep cuts in the library budget and education budgets and other things. And so there seemed to be a broader concern about the direction that he is taking the city. And this just, you know, is compounding that underlying concern about his governance. So I found that the response was not just about the illegal behavior, but about his overall direction he's taking the city in terms of the lack of support for him.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, New York is not alone and it's concern about the issues I'm about to mention, but I spent a fair amount of time in New York City, and you know, people are concerned about the cost of living, that it has been so expensive, and at the same time, you have so many vacant buildings that used to have businesses that aren't coming back. Safety, there's, you know, people being pushed in front of subway trains, et cetera. There's a feeling like it's going back to the bad old days. So crime, cost, garbage, rats. You know, these are the, when you're mayor, you're the person who's in charge of making those things happen or not happen on a day-to-day basis. It's not just a, you know, kind of a meta-level policy issue. Like, you got to make stuff happen.
Right, and that commercial real estate issue is one that cities all across the country, particularly big cities, are facing because in the post-COVID, where, you know, people are working remotely. You just don't need that much commercial space. And the sort of how do you make the transition there, and whether or not people return to work, or does that get repurposed into housing, which is much needed? You know, there's a lot of interesting, complicated questions there. And obviously, I'm not a real estate expert, but is there anything more complicated than U.S. than New York City real estate issues? Right, there are very few cities that have the complications of you know, a little island, not a lot of space, and a lot of demand. So. But it will be interesting to see who his friends are in this and who not. But obviously, there's a lot of churn in the you know, it does perhaps accelerate the Cuomo's decision about whether or not he's going to run for mayor. He's certainly been putting out those signals for a long time. So we live in interesting times.
I'll tell you one silver lining for me. When I pull up TV on my iPad, the first thing that shows up is New York One on my particular service, and usually I quickly turn to whatever I really want to watch. But yesterday I saw Jamani Williams speak for some period of time. I was really impressed. I also think if you listen to what he said and how he's handled it so far, it should give those without spines like Hochul some comfort that she can take the right political action and not worry about the political consequences, even though, by the way, last time I checked, that's not how leaders are supposed to lead. But I will say,
it's less than 24 hours. I don't, you know, it doesn't make sense for her to make a decision.
How long does
right
it take
away
to read the 80-page document and to check it with a couple lawyers?
What's the font size?
Yeah, right?
By
the way,
make
it's
sense.
The 80-page, you get on the other side of the same 80 pages, I think, is Kamala Harris's economic policy. I think they were both 80 pages. But
oh, my goodness. That's just ridiculous.
No, it's not really on the other side. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying Hochul.
Wait, is there anyone else
what
you want to take a swipe at?
What we have here is different senses of humor.
No, but listen.
Not
listen.
Mine.
No, it's just, Why take a swipe at, Vice President Harris's economic proposal?
I didn't. No.
Just did.
No, I was. No, I didn't. I didn't mean to. I was
just
saying.
Did.
No, I was just saying
it
happened.
She laid out an interesting plan.
I was just saying it happened to be.
You like
the,
Trump's plan better?
It happened to be the number of. Same number of pages, if I remember right. That's all I was saying. But taking a swipe at Hochul, just watch Jumaane Williams for 5 minutes and then think to yourself, should the governor be doing something differently? And ask and answer the question yourself.
I think the first question is, what is Adams going to do? This guy is a law enforcement guy. He knows better. The question is, what is he going to do? What are his decisions about whether he's going to... I mean, I know the first reaction is always saying, I'm going to fight this. But after a day or two of taking the temperature, what's he going to do? And I think it's right for the governor to give some space for him to decide what he's going to do before she does something. We agree to disagree.
Yeah.
Panel at WAMC.org. Christopher writes in and poses the question, why is Turkey such a player in bribery? Jim.
So there are some big
Turkish
construction companies that are you know aligned with the state. I mean they're so you know they want favors, and I saw a passing reference to other companies not in the indictment but in the run up to this news maybe a week ago that several other countries were also swirling around in this scandal. Some from the Middle East, some I can't remember the list of them, so I don't want to get it wrong and name them or misname them. But it wasn't just Turkey. But it sounds like Turkey had a very specific request. Again, you know, the kind of the transactional nature of this, that they were building a new consulate in Midtown Manhattan. Teresa, you were talking about the complications of New York real estate and zoning and regulations and all of that. So they're trying to navigate all this, and they need a friend to help them navigate it. Who better than the mayor of New York, who's a former police officer, a former state senator, and has the fire department reporting to him. And so, you know, they had a very kind of specific request. As I was saying, you know, these countries aren't just kind of like generally saying, oh, we want you to like Turkey. They're saying, we want you to do something specific for us. And here it is.
I thought it was particularly ironic that it was Turkey with respect to building codes, because every time there's a tremor or an earthquake over in Turkey, you hear this exposition of all the issues around the ignoring of building codes over there. So it's hilarious that when the letter writer asks why Turkey, they seem to traffic in exceptions in terms of code for buildings, both inside of their country and apparently in New York City.
And this is what I was saying. Turkey's not the only one that suffers this.
It was fire safety issues, yeah.
And a 36-story skyscraper that can be.
Right. Yeah. And for the people in that skyscraper, but also everybody nearby. And
first responders.
And first responders, yeah. I mean, I've seen this play out in other countries, and it's deadly. It's absolutely deadly.
And that's why this is veering off the topic a little bit, but the topic of, you know, building codes and such, that you hear so much talk about, well, we got to get rid of the red tape, and we've got to be able to cut through this, and we've got to reduce the regulations. But at the same time, if something goes wrong, then the question is, okay, why didn't the city do something about it? Why wasn't it more carefully? I mean, I do think there's, you know, there's a whole issue about the value of regulations, and it can slow things down, but it's also often they're there for a reason, right? And to make sure that these places are built right and built safely.
Yeah.
And in some cases, you can intervene in an appropriate way and speed things up. And so I'm not suggesting that this is one of those cases, but there are cases where you can intervene, and that's part of what sort of constituent service often for somebody to do. But the question is, was this one in an appropriate intervention, or was it an appropriate intervention?
Certainly sounds inappropriate.
Yeah.
For the
mayor
to be involved. I would also say that, as I said before, when you've got somebody on the hook, then you can start asking other things. One of the other things that the Turkish government asked of Adams, and he's alleged to have complied, is to not speak out in support of the Armenian population and
right.
a remembrance of the Armenian genocide. New York governors and New York mayors have traditionally once a year put out a statement and in general have been supportive of the Armenian population. And Turkey doesn't like that. They feel like they are unfairly accused of this genocide. And so again, like with Menendez, it started with one thing, and then the Egyptian government, Egyptian intelligence, was asking for a lot more, and he complied, because you can't say no. Once you've gone bad, you're going to keep saying yes.
Panel at WAMC.org. Our panel this morning, Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Ketterer, and Mark Whitman. We will return after this.
You know, you know, you know, you know, you know, you know I got the blues. Well, I got the blues.
Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in studio with public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. You can join the conversation by emailing panel at wamc.org. Teresa, you wanted to discuss yesterday and today, but I don't think you got to it yesterday, the financial plans of the presidential candidates.
Right, I think it's interesting that we saw both candidates give speeches on their economic plans. The economy is the number one issue for the voters. And you really saw the difference in the approach of each, and you know, both the direction and the approach. I mean, former President Trump gave a speech where he repeatedly veered off into other topics, could not stay on message, seemed bored with what he was reading, but did talk tariffs, right? And so his approach is primarily tariffs, and to make sure that his taxes get reauthorized, and because they're set to expire, and as most people know, his proposed tax package that was implemented the last time he was president, it was skewed predominantly to the wealthiest Americans, and it ballooned the deficits in unprecedented ways. And so we know that where that would lead us. Vice President Harris laid out a very different approach, a different focus, a focus on trying to strengthen the middle class as a way to strengthen the whole country, and to focus on ensuring that those that are wealthiest just pay their fair share. We got into that topic a little bit in one of the special panels that we had on taxes and such. And so I thought both their delivery of their message and the message itself gives voters a real clear path. You know, her focus on housing. Well, she talked about building new housing. I would have liked that to expand into not only new housing, but this is, you know, at the margins. But I think you also have to focus on restoring existing housing. And all of that requires a focus on the workforce development, which she did touch on. And then, yes, she has talked about tariffs. People say, well, didn't the Biden-Harris administration used tariffs, but they distinguish in a very targeted way. So I thought it gives people some choice and some meat on the bones in both directions.
I think it's interesting that, you know, there's very few people, I think, who will be inspired to change their vote because of this. I mean, I just think in general there are really no swing voters. There's just such a negligible amount, and so there are undecided voters.
Right.
Undecided meaning are they going to vote? And so
this time, yeah,
meaning getting off
this
people
time.
Get off the couch.
Right.
You need to get
and
people
so
off the couch.
If they get off the couch, they know who they're going to vote for already. It's just will they vote? And so I think that both of these speeches were really aimed at the voters in their bases to say, Here's what I'm saying to you. Here's how this appeals to you. So, you know, when you look through all the distractions and the veering off message for Trump, you know, this kind of, you know, nationalistic approach to international economics very much plays to his base. Whether it makes any sense in terms of economics is a different story, but in terms of the politics, it plays to his base, and his name of the game is to make sure that his base gets out and that they vote. And the same for Harris, that this, you know, there are things in there that play to the various constituencies that are generally going to vote for the Democratic Party. And so, you know, will it work? Will it do it? But I've seen some reporting after the fact this morning, about the swing voter, and I think this is just an absolute illusion, and it's looking back at it at an old time in American politics that doesn't exist anymore. There's no swing voters. There's just undecided voters.
But it's very interesting points, but one of the things that I've noticed in a lot of the people reporting on focus groups, particularly a couple of people who focus on Republicans who are not, you know, they're not sure they're going to stick with Trump or not, or not vote or whatever, is that they keep saying, we want to know more about where she stands. We want to know more about where she stands. And I know that that's, you know, that could mean a lot of different things. But I do think that this, what she laid out and the way she talks about it, I think that that helps to provide a message that may bring some of those people into her column. And I do think it's right that what you really need to pull now is the non-voters, the people who, you know,
or in your camp but might not vote.
In your camp but
right.
might not vote. Because and that's really where what's bumping her numbers up, the extraordinary number of young people who are registering to vote and women who are coming and are energized, sort of key demographics who are energized. And I think you have to get that at the – it's all going to be one at the margins. And the more of those you can sway to get off the couch and vote,
yeah.
the better.
I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, if you really have to, if you have to scour an area and find just enough people for a focus group and they're like, well, we're not really sure who we're going to vote for, I'm sure you could find a handful. But in terms of actually winning an election, that number is so small. It just doesn't matter. What matters is turning out your people and getting them to vote for you. So, I'm very suspicious of these focus groups. I'm very suspicious of this perpetual media narrative of the swing voter. And I think the campaigns also on both sides are suspicious of it. They know what the game is. And I think both of these speeches were designed to speak to their bases, to motivate them, to say, we hear you. And I do agree that, you know, Harris needs to, I think, step up some specificity on some of her policy proposals. And this was a step in that direction.
Mark Whitman, your eyebrows went very high and then very low. What's on your mind?
He's about to explode. You can see he's going to explode.
Well, no, there's so much here. Look, Trump, let's just deal with Trump's policies. First of all, he's mendacious. He'll never get it all enacted. But if he ever did, inflation would spike back up and we'd be in a recession within a year. So his policies would be a disaster for the U.S., and even he would eventually self-correct. I actually think I remember the story, at least I read it. I don't know if it was true, that allegedly Gore, literally an hour before the polls closed in Florida, was in the diners trying to find and convince people who hadn't yet voted.
That was a long time ago.
But my point
and
is—
And he lost.
If you said to Kamala Harris, I've got a way to get you another half percentage of the vote in Michigan— I mean, that campaign would spend an unlimited amount of money. And if you look, and so I think I can explain what we're seeing with Kamala Harris in the following. If you look over the summer, YouGov and The Economist did a very specific analysis across polling and found that of those who were switching, used to support Biden, and at the time then we're going to transition over to Trump, they tended to be young, working families with children. And if you look at the party favors that Kamala Harris is offering, it does seem like she got the message that those are voters that she needs to either keep in their seats in the Democratic Party or bring over to her. Look, Kamala Harris's economic proposal is not nearly as bad as the other guys. It's got a lot of rainbows and unicorns in it that will never come to pass or have any real effect. But obviously, it speaks a much more sensible custodianship of this economy than Donald Trump's policies. I mean, in a way, I didn't need to see what her policy was. I do agree that there are voters who allegedly don't understand how her policies line up with her views, and there's some hewing and crying about they need more of that. But the question is, do you really? I mean, decision between the two of these is so stark. It's amazing. But I will say, responsible economists that I'm aware of put their head in their hands when they read a lot of what Kamala Harris has put out. A lot of it's, you know, rainbows and unicorns, and it's...
Well, I I think there were a number of our economists who said it was she had some good plans and important plans there, too. But to the issue of an anecdote about pulling voters out, I worked in the Clinton campaign in New Hampshire in 92. And they were working so hard to pull out every voter. One of the things that they were asking about is there were a whole group of people in northern New Hampshire who were French speakers. And so my parents, who were French speakers, came from upstate New York and drove to New Hampshire and spent the entire day sitting in a hotel room, phone banking in French to a group of about 300 potential voters who were French-speaking, encouraging them to get out to vote. I mean, that's how much they were trying to and by the way, they were then, this one person, this field guy was delightful. He came in and showed them, look how many people voted. But they were tracking so carefully that they knew there were this group of people, French speakers, were probably inclined to vote for him, but were not necessarily inclined to vote.
But, you know, I think the game has changed a lot since 1992. Right. It's just not the same game.
Well, no, but what about the fact that she is, Harris is going into rural parts of Pennsylvania that typically a Democrat hasn't gone into because she's trying to pick up votes at the margin?
Yeah, I mean, let's see if it works. One of the things that the country has undergone, and we can see that the political parties have undergone over the past 30 years, is there was a great book written about it called The Big Sort, that the country is really
great
just
book.
Sorting out, and happening on political levels, it's happening on the level of work, it's happening on the level of who people decide to marry, and they're sorting out into camps in a way that they didn't before. And you can even see it in the parties. I mean, you know, back in those days and preceding that, you know, you had Democrats like Scoop Jackson, who was a, you know, conservative Democrat, and you had liberal Republicans, and you had really a different kind of dynamic of the electorate and of the body politic. And I think that one of the things that Trump realized and took advantage of in 2016 was that's not the game anymore. The game is identify your base, solidify it, motivate it, and ride it as much as you can.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. You can also donate anytime online at WAMC.org. The panel this morning, Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Ketterer, and Mark Whitman. I'm Sarah LeDuc in for Joe Donahue, and we will return after regional news with Ray Graff.
Life's a losing gamble to me. Everybody knows I'm moaning.
Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc, in for Joe Donahue, who shall return on Monday. Scheduled day off? Don't worry about him. I mean, you know, he's fine. The music this morning by Ekep Nkwele, a Cameroonian-American jazz vocalist, a star on the rise, performing a program entitled Ella Fitzgerald Against All Odds at Hudson Hall in Hudson, New York, should be a stunning concert of songs from the American Songbook, that taking place October 4th through the 6th at Hudson Hall. You can learn more at hudsonhall.org. Ekep Nkwele performing on the 4th. You can donate to the Lockbox anytime. Lockbox is available always at WAMC.org. You can join this conversation by emailing us, panel@WAMC.org. The panel this morning, public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. President Zelensky is in the United States. It's Ukraine's president, of course. President Joe Biden on Thursday said that billions of dollars of defense that he has authorized for Ukraine will strengthen Kyiv's hand in future negotiations. He met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in the Oval Office for what could be the final time during Biden's presidency. Sitting alongside Zelensky, Biden thanked the Ukrainian leader for sharing his own plans for victory in his country's nearly three-year-old war against Russia's invading forces. The Ukrainian leader also met with Vice President Kamala Harris, of course, Democratic candidate for president, in her ceremonial office in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, during which Harris, the Democratic presidential nominee, as I just mentioned, told Zelensky that her support for Kyiv's defense is unwavering. She said, quote, I have been proud to stand with Ukraine. I will continue to stand with Ukraine, and I will work to ensure Ukraine prevails in this war to be safe, secure, and prosperous. The United States must continue to fulfill our longstanding role of global leadership. She warned that allowing Putin and Russia to prevail would embolden the Russian leader to further threaten NATO members such as Poland and other Baltic states. Zelensky was sent to meet with former President Donald Trump, the Republican candidate for president in New York, but that was initially canceled. It has since been said that Trump plans to meet with the Ukrainian leader today. We shall see. Jim.
Yeah, I think that meeting with Trump is going on
right
as we
now.
Speak.
Yeah.
In Trump Tower. And so, you know, the world leaders are gathering in New York for the UN General Assembly, and Zelensky is there for that. And Donald Trump is in New York, so they're meeting in Trump Tower. You know, I think that what you just read, Sarah, has some of those kind of squishy terms that I think candidates ought to be held accountable to on both sides and say, okay, what do you really mean? What does it mean to stand with Ukraine? What does victory look like for Ukraine? Is it total victory? Is it retaking Crimea? Is it retaking the southeast part of Ukraine, the Donbas? And what is the path to that the United States would support? Will the candidates who are running for office when they're going to be commander-in-chief, would they support allowing the Ukrainians to do more of the kinds of incursions into territorial Russia, to use advanced weaponry to strike deep into Russia, maybe even into Moscow? I mean, you could imagine if you're Ukrainian, you say, look, they're striking Kyiv. We should be able to strike Moscow. Do you allow that? So if you're Vice President Harris, people should be saying, what would you allow? What would you do? What is the plan? And Trump has said that, you know, he would strike a deal. He's the deal maker of all time. But then, well, what is actually the deal? You know, if there's negotiations now and the Russians, it seems like the Trump plan would be that the Russians would be allowed to keep what they've got now. That is clearly a victory. But it's not just about territory. It's also about what is the future of Ukraine and its relationship with the West? What is its relationship with NATO? What is NATO's relationship with Russia and with itself in defending the Baltic states that you had mentioned and Poland? What would Ukraine's relationship be with other Western European and international institutions? These are the things, I think, as much if not more than the territory that Putin really cares about. So the devil's in the details. There's not a lot of details in these platitudes. And, you know, Zelensky is kind of, you know, going to meet with whoever he thinks might be able to help him and, you know, kind of making sure he meets with both sides because he doesn't know what's going to happen in November. But, you know, the situation with Ukraine is, I mean, it's not a clear path to victory. And in fact, you know, the Ukrainians are running out of troops. They're having, you know, they're facing this kind of grinding down Russian military that's made lots of mistakes and has been inept in many ways. But there's a lot more Russians than there are Ukrainians. And I think Putin is playing the long game, and Zelensky is running out of time.
Mark?
So there's been a fallacy that the United States has publicly stated over and over again, which is the Ukrainians get to decide how this ends in war, but that's not really true because the Ukrainians can go only so far as we back them, frankly, and that's always been a constraint. I think Jim's right. I think if you look at the situation in Ukraine in terms of people, in terms of politics, and in terms of military, I think the United States needs to take a leadership role and redefine success. I think success means conceding territories, if not formally, at least informally. You know, see Hong Kong, Taiwan, North and South Korea. The Economist talked about the precedent of allowing Germany to enter NATO when it was split into East and West Germany. And so the point NATO made was, we're not conceding that East Germany is yours, but if you start marching into West Germany, we will provide a direct deterrent to that. And I think the United States needs to consider that, frankly. So I think we need to get a lot more realistic. And by the way, I don't think Ukrainians, my understanding is many of the Ukrainians knew that they were going to have to give up territory. They didn't want some separatist group from the Donbas becoming a militant group of terrorists in the middle of Kyiv when this was all over. It just wasn't worth it. The one thing that I can't get my head around is as Jim said, this wasn't just about land. Part of this, I think, was clearly about Putin worrying about a westward-leaning country being successful on his border. A lot of it, too, was the Orwellian war is peace from internally within Russia, and that Putin had lost the prospect of holding out economic success for his country under the kleptocracy that he runs, and instead had basically had to put the place on lockdown with the war as an excuse. So the one thing that even if you come up with the perfect – Donald Trump comes up with a perfect solution for the Soviet Union, I don't know how you – I don't know how you satiate Putin's need, which is going to be at war indefinitely. And I'm not sure how you sort that out. But I do think the United States needs to take a more definitive leadership role. The other thing I'd say is a lot of people like me said, I don't know why Biden isn't letting the Ukrainians using our weapons as far as they reach, so long as they're legitimate targets. Apparently, the concern all along has been that the Russians will turn around and give the Houthis better missiles or start to help the Iranians or even some of the Iranian proxies.
Exactly.
I get that fear, but you know what? We're the United States. You know, it's we need to do what's right, and if bad actors keep doing bad things, then we'll correct for it when and as we see it. So I understand the threat more than I do. I understand it's not just such a free call as we used to say it, but I do think we ought to more seriously consider those costs. But again, the one thing I don't know how we solve is Putin's need, which is going to be, you know, is going to exist as long as he does, is to be at war. And I'm not sure what we do about that.
But so can I ask, so before I say what I think, what land do you think that the Ukrainians should give up? If you're saying, well, the Ukrainians have to give up some land, what land do you propose they give up?
Well, I think it's been clear from the beginning that they're never getting Crimea back. And when I say clear from the beginning, if you remember, even Elon Musk wouldn't let them use his satellite links to target into Crimea, and the U.S. government seemed to be on board with that. So I think that's long gone. I think there are some areas of the Donbass, the far reaches of the Donbass, that are basically within the sphere of the media and political influence of Russia anyway, and were so cleared out after the initial incursion that it's not as much of a loss. I think it gets a little shadier whether or not, you know, you probably don't pick current lines, but you probably back them up a bit from the Russians, a bit from where they are. But I do think there's an outline of a deal here. And again, I don't think you have to say this is forever yours, but you put some sort of agreement in place that says, you know, if you come any further, NATO gets directly involved. Because in order for this to stop...
Yeah, but they said that after Crimea, right? And now so now they've come further, and so now you want to give them more land, right? So what? I don't know where it stops.
It stops. I mean, look, East and West Germany stopped in Berlin. So there's historical precedent for saying, okay, nothing we can do about you there, but we're going to draw a line and don't cross it. I mean, there is historical precedent.
What if it doesn't stop till Poland?
Well, then, no. If they would have taken Berlin, you know, if they would have come over the wall, NATO would have gotten involved. They knew that, and that's what kept the peace. We need to recreate that.
But let's be clear about one thing about the Crimea action in 2014. When the Russians took, or if you have the Russian perspective, retook Crimea, that was a violation of a document that the United States had signed on to called the Budapest Memorandum.
Right.
That was a document that was signed. The Ukrainians had inherited some nuclear weapons when the Cold War ended. Basically, they said, we'll give up these nuclear weapons, but in return, we want to make sure that our territorial integrity is protected. And so the British, the Americans, the Russians, and the Ukrainians signed this document. When the Russians took Crimea in 2014, what happened? Nothing.
Nothing.
The Obama administration hedged and shilly-shallied and basically made a decision to do nothing. Number one, this sent very negative signals to our NATO allies, because I was in Ukraine in 2014, and I was having conversations with people who were from some of the delegations from the Baltic states, and they were saying, do you really think that the United States would go to war with Russia to save Lithuania or Estonia? And obviously, their inclination after the Budapest Memorandum failure was no. that we would not, that we would not live up to Article 5 of the NATO Charter that requires that we come to defense of any country that had been violated. So people haven't forgotten that.
Right.
And so the you know, kind of the American word on where we're going to draw a red line, and don't forget it was the Obama administration that drew a red line in Syria that it didn't live up to. And so there's a real sense of unease about what the U.S. would agree to and what it will actually back up.
Right, but that's why I'm asking, you know, sort of where's the line with the land? Because it just keeps inching further and inching further and inching further. And so I think, let's be clear, I don't think that Trump is going to come up with any great grand deal. I think he's going to do whatever Putin wants him to do. And, you know, and what worries me is he keeps saying, you know, this will be done before I get into office, which is that murky middle of time where the president, you know, is one president at a time. And he's basically saying, I'm going to violate that norm if I win. You know, I'm going to take over right away. And I think that for many reasons, that's problematic. But I also think that, well, let's just hope he doesn't win. But I also think it's important to remember what President Biden did yesterday, which he announced when he was meeting with Zelensky. We talk about Harris and Trump's meetings, but I thought Biden's is equally or more intriguing because he did some very specific things, which is he's much more forward-facing on this new package of funding. And clearly it appears to be, when you say clearly, it doesn't appear to be. It appears that it's for the purpose of making sure to hedge against if Trump wins, to make sure that these resources are committed to Ukraine in a way that they can't be pulled back, and also bringing in, strengthening even further the NATO partnership that's aligned with Ukraine, so to buffer against any of the downside of Trump winning, because Trump's made clear that he's just going to give up Ukraine. And he also talked about the need to grow the internal capacity in Ukraine to strengthen its long-term security. And some of the money is targeted toward that, and also their internal fight against corruption. And so I thought that he laid out a very specific and fairly important pathway to basically reinforce what he has focused on in the last 4 years around, you know, strengthening NATO and growing out the coalition so it's not just the U.S. So if Trump abandons them, they're not left alone.
Catherine writes into panel at WAMC.org and says, I'm kind of shocked at Mark Whitman's faux realism proposing making a deal with Putin. You do not negotiate with megalomaniacs. Tim Snyder's lesson one, do not obey in advance.
Well, but there's no every conflict that ends at a negotiating table. So, you know, don't negotiate with Putin. Fine, we can wait till he's not there anymore and negotiate at that point. But that's not a realistic answer. So, I mean, think about it during the middle of the Vietnam War. If you would have said, you know, yeah, Nixon and Kissinger are going to cut a deal at the height of it, people would have said, what are you kidding me? Right? How can we do that? We can't negotiate with the other side or let China prevail. The answer is, you're going to have to come to a reasonable solution at some point, because continuing the war indefinitely is an illusion that will lead to Ukraine being overrun.
But Zelensky's clearly signaling that he's aware of that. And one of the reasons he's pushing to target deeper into Russia and to very, very particular strikes at weapons caches and things like that, it seems to me, I'm no expert, you guys are the experts, but it seems to me he's doing that so that when he gets to the bargaining table, he has a stronger hand to play, right? Isn't that why he's doing that? And also to expose some weaknesses that Putin has, right?
Right,
and,
yeah.
And it really has. It has demonstrated many of their weaknesses, just like going into some of the land and anyway.
And I think it highlights something that people should be reminded of, that there's not, you know, kind of diplomacy on one side and then the conduct of war on the other, that these things are inextricably linked.
Right.
And so the nature of what's going on the battlefield and who's winning where and who's winning what is going to have a lot to do with who's able to have the upper hand and even have a seat at the table in diplomatic negotiations if they happen. This kind of conversation we're having now is happening a lot in Washington, too, and it doesn't break down along partisan lines. I mean, there's a real debate about, you know, what is victory really going to mean? And if we negotiate, what's that really going to mean in Ukraine? And you're totally right, Mark. This is the reality is it's not just for the Ukrainians to decide. It's their country, but there's a lot of other people who have interests in this. And so I think, you know, to the letter writer's point, and by the way, Tim Snyder at Yale, I mean, somebody I highly recommend that people read. He knows this probably better than anybody, and he's definitely worth reading. That having been said, if the end game that's desired by the United States is complete and total victory and Ukrainian control over all of its territory, then the United States needs to say to Americans, this is what it's going to take, folks. Here's what we're going to have to do. If we're going to break this stalemate with the Russians, who were dug in and, in fact, advancing in Ukraine, this is the kind of sacrifice that we're going to have to make. These are the kind of things we're going to have to do. This is what we're going to have to allow the Ukrainians to do. And these are the sorts of risks that will arise because of it. And you can say, till the cows come home, we support complete and total victory. Okay. How and at what cost?
Right. But I also think it's not just the U.S. in that conversation in Ukraine. It's NATO countries in that conversation, because it's really protecting the buffer. I mean, Ukraine is really, you know, the fight is in Ukraine, but for everybody, right? And that's and so I think that it's a broader group of people at the table. But the other thing that worries me is that if the Trump administration, if Trump does win, part of this needs to be diplomatic negotiation, both in that region and certainly in the Middle East and what's going on in Lebanon and Israel, we need to get to in other areas. And I looked at Project 2025 the other day, the section on the State Department, and we saw what Trump did in the first administration to decimate the State Department, and it's an even broader attack that's laid out in Project 2025 about wanting to politicize all leadership positions in the State Department, want to drastically reduce the number of people in the State Department, make some very, very, they're proposing some very, very specific changes there. And so what does that do? What will that do to the ability to negotiate the delicate issues in Ukraine and building coalitions with NATO? At the same time, you're in the Sudan. At the same time, you have what's going on in Israel and Lebanon and Gaza and so on and so forth, all around in China, not to mention China. So, I mean, I think there are a lot of serious questions on the table with some foreboding when, you know, skies up ahead if he wins.
Chris writes in to panel at WAMC.org and says, why won't the U.S. and Western allies shoot down Russian missiles and drones before they hit Ukraine? We did when Iran sent a barrage to Israel.
Jim? Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question.
Right.
I mean, I know that over time, a lot of money has been invested in creating a protective dome in Israel. And I just assume that has not been done in Ukraine, which is doesn't have the same relationship with the United States, number one. And number two, you know, it's a vast territory.
Yeah, isn't it a geographic issue?
Yeah, I mean, I would assume so. But the you know, the U.S. has basically taken the line, and NATO in general, that Ukraine ought to be using the weapons we give them for defensive purposes. And you know, what is the definition of that? Is a good offense the best defense? A good defense the best offense? I mean, you know, I think that the Ukrainians have decided not to completely pay attention to that directive. Obviously, the incursion into Kursk is one example of that. But I don't have a great answer for that letter writer.
The answer is historical, geographic, and the other part of the answer is the minute we shoot down one of their planes, we're killing Russians. The minute we start killing Russians outside of perhaps a error in Syria a while back, which we could talk about, the minute we start to directly start killing lots of Russians, we're putting U.S. service people in harm's way. And when we do that, we've learned as a country, can I say the word for donkey on the air? We don't do that half donkey. We make sure that our people are properly protected. And the minute we do that, we have to take out Russia's air defenses anywhere near the Ukrainian border. And the minute we do that, it becomes possibly an existential threat to those currently in the Kremlin. So you pull on that thread, i.e. start putting U.S. people shooting at Russians, and it gets dark quick. That's why that's the other reason we've decided not to do it.
Yeah, and this is a balance that the Biden administration has been trying to strike all along. You know, try to defend Ukraine and not start World War III.
Right. And it's not unlike, and presumably we're going to switch to it, it's not unlike what's going on in, you know, the calculations you need to make in Gaza and Lebanon and Israel and pick your other areas, right? The Yemen, the sort of, what we can't do, what we're telling them that they can't do. You know, we can't do stuff and then say, well, you can't do it. Right.
Linda writes in and says, could Jim please comment on what rebuilding Ukraine would cost and look like? This will be a very expensive undertaking. And I'll add that they're not even, you know, in a position to begin yet.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the price tag would be. And then it's also going to be dependent on who gets what territory. I would assume that if there are negotiations over things like that, there will be also negotiations and incentives that have to do with this very issue. Who pays for reconstruction? Who is involved in reconstructing what part of it? And, you know, if Ukraine is able to recapture all of its territory, okay, who does that? But if part of it remains under Russian control, who does that and why and in what way? You know, I suspect that if there are those kinds of negotiations, the southeastern part of Ukraine might not become Russian, might become under some kind of international stewardship or protectorate. So then who's in charge of security for it, but also who's in charge of reconstruction? I mean, that's a part of Ukraine that has been, you know, hit very, very hard, and that's where a lot of it would have to happen. So it's not just the dollar figures. I think it's also a complicated political and security challenge.
Our panel this morning is Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Ketterer, and Mark Whitman. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. You can also contribute to the lockbox at wamc.org, and we will return with more roundtable panel after news from the BBC.
Times when grief and strife were part of a world. Welcome
to the final segment of this morning's roundtable panel. Actually, the last burst for the week, in fact. Joining me in studio, I'm Sarah LaDuc, by the way, is Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Ketterer, and Mark Whitman. The music this morning by Ekep Nkwele, performing as part of the Hudson Jazz Festival in Hudson, New York, October 4th through the 6th, hudsonhall.org, to learn more about that. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. Let us discuss Netanyahu currently in New York City, maybe right now addressing the UN. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said yesterday that he vowed to carry out full force strikes against Hezbollah until it ceases firing rockets across the border, dimming hope for a ceasefire proposal put forth by U.S. and European officials. Israel carried out a new strike in the Lebanese capital, which killed a senior Hezbollah commander, and the militant group launched dozens of rockets into Israel. Tens of thousands of Israeli and Lebanese people living near their country's borders have been displaced by the fighting. He spoke as he arrived in New York, Netanyahu did, to attend the annual gathering of world leaders at the UN General Assembly, where U.S. and European officials were putting heavy pressure on both sides of the conflict to accept a proposed 21-day halt in fighting to give time for diplomacy and avert an all-out war. This is from the AP. Nearly 700 people have been killed in Lebanon this week as Israel dramatically escalated strikes, saying it is targeting the military capacity of Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed Shiite group that is the strongest armed force in Lebanon. Israeli leaders say they are determined to stop the group's cross-border attacks, which began after the Hamas militant group's October 7th attack last year that ignited the war in Gaza. Jim.
Yeah, we were just talking about Ukraine and what does victory mean, and how do you get to it, and then what comes next? These are the same sorts of questions we have to look at with this situation in Lebanon. You know, there's a history of Israel and Lebanon, And Israel went into Lebanon in the early 80s, and then they ended up being bogged down there for a long time in a kind of a Vietnam sort of quagmire that really didn't solve any of the kind of national security issues that they were trying to solve, and at the same time had really profound effects on Israeli society. And lots of pushback, lots of protest. And so this idea of saying, okay, you know, our victory from the Israeli perspective is going to be eliminating the military capacity, whether this is Hezbollah or Hamas in Gaza. And so if you can, you know, in fact prevail on that tactical level, how can you actually also enhance the strategic position of Israel, the safety and security of Israelis, in this case Israelis who were living in the north? How can you really not just prevail over this military capacity, which certainly the Israelis have the power to do, but how can you create a situation where you have a political horizon that allows for a safer Israel going forward, which allows for the reduction of the nature of these conflicts over time? I mean, for a long time, Israel and Hezbollah have been stuck in this tit-for-tat game that has now, you know, with all of the other pressures in the region, has just kind of spiraled out of control. But is the plan to go back to some version of that? It sounds like maybe Netanyahu is saying no, they want something else. But what and how? Again, the devil's in the details. So it will be interesting to see what he has to say to the UN General Assembly. And it's going to be interesting to see how other diplomats at the UN and other leaders who are there respond to this.
I think the UN is almost irrelevant here in the short run. I think I know what's going on. Israel figured out that Iran wasn't going to back up Hezbollah. They straight punched them with the assassination in Tehran, and Iran now seems more interested in diplomatic entreaties to the U.S. and to the West than backing up Hezbollah. There are 40,000 plus Israelis that are displaced. If there was a country, you know, Pacifica or Atlantica off of our borders that had thrown people out of California or Maine in those numbers, we would take care of it militarily. That is not to ignore why that problem exists historically or to ignore the civilian cost that's being extracted. Some of the civilian casualties have been as bad as days during the Lebanon's civil war. So it's gruesome. Let's not ignore that. But Israel's taken out, by estimates, about half of Hezbollah's missile capacity. That starts to become a threat to Iran, who always assumed, well, knew that that was a buffer that they would unleash if they were ever attacked directly by Israel and or the United States. But what they haven't, Israel, basically the assumption is Israel's never going to want to put boots on the ground, even the military doesn't, that was their Vietnam. What they're going to do is keep going until most of the medium-range missile capacity has been incapacitated. Going after the long-run missile capacity is apparently a lot more costly, both in terms of those are hardened targets, and with too many of Israel's allies, those targets are probably placed under civilian centers. Surprise, surprise. So Israel's going to keep going after that now that Iran is attenuated in their response. But they're not going to go further, because if they do start to threaten the long-run missile capability, it really does start to cut into Iran and Iran's defense, and they're sort of in a use-it-or-lose-it position. The other thing that this does for Netanyahu is it allows him to continue the war, which obviously which he likes, and neither he nor Yahya Sinwar want a deal over in Gaza, and it allows the Israelis to start to decouple the demands of Hezbollah, who said, we're going to keep shooting until you have cut a deal over in Gaza. So it allows him to decouple that. And, Hassan Nasrallah is going to have to back down here because he's got no backing or nowhere to go otherwise. So eventually he'll climb down. They'll go back past the river. I don't remember the name of it. There is a border that Hezbollah is supposed to be behind, according to
right.
international agreements. And Israel will hopefully be able to repopulate those that have had to leave their homes. It will come at a great civilian cost. It will continue this rope-a-dope that inures to Netanyahu's benefit, where he never has to leave office because he's always in a war. I mean, there are lots of, don't get me wrong, I'm not saluting what's happening here, but I do think the lines are pretty clear.
So I don't even begin to understand what's going on there. I have more questions than comments.
That's
on
fine.
This.
Pose your questions.
But the spiraling out of control is the phrase that I think is, it just appears to be spiraling out of control. And is that for Netanyahu's political benefits? Is that why it's spiraling out of control? That's a question, not a statement. And it's not that I disagree. I don't understand what you just said about the decoupling of, you know, what's going on in Gaza versus what's going on in Lebanon, because it seems with the Hezbollah, because it seems that the, you know, as they try to get close to an agreement in Gaza, then Netanyahu ticks up the aggression either in Gaza or now in Lebanon to distract from the ability to reach an agreement. And so clearly he doesn't appear to want an agreement. It seems to me, again, no deep understanding of this at all, but there's the wholesale leveling of Gaza, whereas in Lebanon it's just been these more what they're noted for, these targeted surgical strikes, and with the you know, the telecommunications, whether he should have done that or not, if that's a proper, you know, tactic in war or not, but it was highly, highly targeted. So it raises a question, why wasn't there more targeted efforts in Gaza rather than the wholesale demolition of the area? But I just don't understand where he's going with this. It seems he's losing the support of a lot of his people, but not the political coalition that he needs to hold together to stay in office. Is this just so he can stay in office? Or what's the strategy here? Because he's leaving a lot of, you know, enormous amount of death in the wake of what he's doing.
Yeah, and this is really expensive for Israel, too. That's another reason why they can only go so far. I mean, this is starting to really decrease their short and intermediate term economic prospects. It's cost them a lot in a lot of ways.
And globally, global support, I mean, how is he going to be welcomed today at the UN, right?
Well, apparently he was there, and as the BBC reported, I'm sure a number of people walked out. But look, I mean, again, let's ignore how you got there. If 50,000 Californians were displaced because the nation of Pacifica were sending rockets our way, we'd make it stop. I mean, and the make it stop here is
for what? For people on the air who don't know, how were they? What's the issue there?
Well, Hamas had hoped and called for Hezbollah to join the fight with all their might. That wasn't going to happen because the might that Hezbollah has is largely the Iranian might. The Iranians have spent billions of dollars arming Hezbollah as a defensive buffer. And so Hezbollah went back to this pro forma tit-for-tat rocket fire. 40,000 to 50,000 Israelis were displaced because basically Israel was being used as the buffer zone between the Hezbollah forces in Lebanon and Israel. And Israel said, enough, we're gonna push the buffer zone back to Lebanon, not in our country. And again, I think there's a pretty clear line here. If they start to go after political assassinations and or start to go after Iran's long-range capabilities, the Iranians are kind of in that use it or lose it conundrum that the Israelis were allegedly in when apparently Hezbollah found out that some of these pagers were rigged and it was going to, you know, eventually they were going to ditch them all and Israel was going to lose that asset. Again, I'm not saying it was morally right to use it or not. I'm just saying it was a similar situation. So I actually don't think this is as out of control as the media says. I think they don't understand. I do think there are parts of the media, if you read, for instance, the Financial Times, The Economist, they've got the contours of this in a lot more nuance than you get out of U.S. sources. And I think there is sort of a next stop on the train of destruction, which is, again, I'm not saying it's a good train or the destruction's good, but the next stop is that Israel's getting pretty – Israel's not going to put boots on the ground, and they're not going to be able to destroy all of Iran's long-run capability.
And maybe Jim knows the answer to this, but this is a question, not a comment. But how is what Netanyahu is doing in the West Bank, which is pushing Palestinians out with increasing, you know, Israeli settlements, different from what he's, you know, stopping with the sort of the loss of land for the Israelis? I mean, how are those different?
I never really thought of the connection between those two. I mean, and just in terms of the West Bank, one thing that I've talked about a lot on this program over the last couple of years is that I really have fully expected and continue to expect that the precarious situation in the West Bank to implode at some point. And I thought that was going to be the place that was going to have the big flare-up and not Gaza, because it is just an untenable situation. And I think that it is not, it's terrible for Palestinians, but it's also bad for Israel's long-term security purposes. However, the current makeup of the Israeli government includes people who are settlers in the West Bank and who have a very kind of maximalist view of Israeli presence in those territories. So in terms of connecting it to the north and what's going on with Lebanon.
It's moving people out of their territory.
Yeah, I mean,
displacing people.
There's some way we could think about it, but I think we don't have time.
We are out of time for this morning, unfortunately, but I thank you all, as always, for being here. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, have a nice weekend. I know we are thinking about people in the south affected by Hurricane Helene. We hope that there's, you know, as little destruction as possible and hopefully no loss of human life. Also joined by senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. I hope you all have a pleasant weekend.
Thank you.
You can give to the lockbox at WAMC.org absolutely anytime. WAMC.org. It's important that we raise our funds to keep the fund drive short. Please do what you can when you can. And if now is when you can, that would be marvelous. And we would really appreciate it. It's WAMC.org. The Congressional Corner is next on the Roundtable.